Welcome to the Goddesses of Social Work podcast, hosted by Renita Ray Davis, licensed clinical social worker, board-approved social work clinical supervisor, and facilitator of the Goddesses of Social Work supervision community. Join us as we travel through the social work journeys told by the Goddesses of Social Work community members, past and present, as they make their way toward clinical licensure.
Welcome to the Goddesses of Social Work podcast and our special series highlighting speakers and guests of the upcoming Affirming Our Presence Behavioral Health Conference, June 20th through the 23rd in Plano, Texas. I'm your host, Renita Ray Davis, and I'm here today with Camila Thomas, MSW, LCSWS, whose Affirming Our Presence conference topic is Empower Her Presence, Elevating Your Client Attraction Game. Camila Thomas, she, her, hers, is a seasoned licensed psychotherapist, clinical supervisor, coach, speaker, and entrepreneur, boasting over 15 years of extensive clinical and managerial expertise. A graduate of the University of Houston with a master's in social work, she currently holds the positions of CEO and clinical director of her own mental health group practice. Founded in 2018, KBT Counseling and Consulting was established by Camila to create a safe space for Black women to unpack their emotional distress and vulnerabilities in a safe and supportive therapeutic environment. Her proficiency as an EMDR-trained licensed psychotherapist is tailored towards entrepreneurs and the strong Black woman, helping them work through challenges such as depression, anxiety, life transitions, trauma, dysfunctional relationships, perfectionism, and self-sabotage. In addition to being a therapist, Camila has provided business coaching to other therapists who desire to build or scale a six-figure private practice and life coaching to help the overcommitted and stressed woman shift from surviving to thriving. Welcome to the show, Camila.
Hello, Renita. Thank you so much for having me here. I really appreciate this opportunity.
Awesome. We're glad to have you. Camila, I love reading your bio and the phrase, the strong Black woman. As soon as I read it, though, the phrase magical Black girl came to mind. And I thought about how much pressure it is sometimes to feel magical. Can you expound on your expertise on the strong Black woman?
Absolutely. She is me and I am she. So I think having a lived experience with this persona while also having professional experience and the wonderful women that I work with, I just have a really deep understanding, passion, and special place in my heart just to make sure that we know that it is okay not to be okay. We don't have to continue this facade that we are trying to keep it all together. That we have to juggle a million things, that we're responsible for other people and trying to save them. But we really can reclaim our time, our peace, and energy to make sure that we're living the best life that we deserve.
Absolutely. And, you know, when I was reading your bio and seeing all of those symptomologies, depression, anxiety, life transition, traumas, dysfunctional relationships, perfectionism, and self-sabotage.
Life.
Really. I guess I'm wondering, and I am having that lived experience as well. Before we hit record, I was like, I'm just trying to take the Bristix out and do this podcast and, you know, trying to juggle all of the things all at one time. In what ways do you feel like you help people, specifically strong Black women, transition through some of these tougher symptoms?
Yeah, I think definitely I always try to lay a good foundation to make sure that we're clear on understanding what exactly the problem is and how we got here before we're jumping to try to solve it. Because I think every woman who identifies as being strong, hyper-independent, overcommitted, sometimes our journeys and the ways that we have become are a little bit different. And so really kind of understanding what exactly are those five traits of the superwoman schema. So that way a woman can actually identify, okay, yes, this is the character that I have embodied. And in what ways is this starting to be detrimental to me? A lot of times what has happened is we've developed skills that at one point were great for survival, right? But now sometimes in the present, do we still need to continue operating in that same way? Sometimes we're still operating in survival mode when we really should be in a place of thriving. So really kind of helping her understand. And then part of my coaching program, we go over 5 key concepts. So one is going to be boundary mastery. The other is going to be self-compassion. Another is going to take a layer deeper than self-care, but really looking at what soul care really looks like. We'll also be talking about empowered surrender, which is how we can really let go of control and allow other people to be able to help us. And then the other part of that is emotional liberation, where we are free to really express ourselves. So instead of suppressing emotions, we can actually express them, so we're not so heavy and so burdened by trying to keep everything in.
Oh, that is absolutely beautiful. I love that so much. The two things, if I can just say, stood out to me was soul care and liberation of emotion. And I, you know, you can speak to either one if you want to. I don't want you to go too deep into your program, but I love the idea of soul care. But even as you said, liberation of emotion, I'm just thinking of our ancestors who weren't allowed to cry when their children were snatched from them or their families were separated. And how, as Black women, we've kind of taken that on and not, you just don't cry. And so for you to talk to Black women about liberating their emotions seems so powerful.
Absolutely. There's definitely a historical and cultural implication for this strong Black woman. And you talked about, you know, our enslaved ancestors. And so we have to think about it way back then for Black women. We were responsible for caring for the families of our slave masters, right? There are pictures where you can see Black women who are actually breastfeeding their, you know, the children, the infants of their white slave owners. So not only that, they still had to tend to the field. So literally all day they were giving to everything, everyone. And what then did they have less when they returned back home, right? And so it starts early on, and we can just kind of see through times how Black women have still had to step up to the plate to be able to be sometimes the primary caregiver. If the fathers were incarcerated, if they were away to war, or for some reason just otherwise absent. It could have been during the drug crack pandemics that also impacted our Black community, and particularly Black men as well. So again, all of these things came from a place of survival, and emotions were seen as a sign of weakness. If you watch movies like Roots and things like that, it is still, even when being beaten, still trying to manifest this sense of strength and power, even when we're going through the most horrific things that could happen to us, right? Because if they saw us crying, we could further be a target. In certain communities, again, weakness, any portrayal of weakness or vulnerability makes you a target. And so, again, as a way of survival, we had to put on this mask. At some point, I think what I've noticed is that what at one point became a source of pride has now become a source of pressure, right? So I've heard women say, well, there's the matriarchs in my family, my grandmama, big mama, my auntie, my mama, I saw them so strong. What you didn't see is that grandmama was tired. Big mama was tired. She was tired, but she didn't have the words for that. And so we look up to these women who can seemingly handle it all without complaint, without outwardly expressing any emotions or distress. And that somehow we have seen as strength and power, when really what would have happened if grandmama or big mama actually had help, if she actually had a support system, if she actually could afford to say, no, I'm tired, I don't want to do this anymore, right? There was no language about boundaries. There was no language around emotional expression. We just had to do what we had to do to make it to another day. And so I think it's really important to say, even though that may have been our ancestors' struggles, it may have been Big Mama's struggle, it doesn't mean that it has to be mine. And so how can we redefine what vulnerability, what real strength looks like in a way that is not so detrimental and costly to us? Because I think that's what's happening now. We look good on the outside, right? We like to say, oh, Black doesn't crack. But internally, our organs are cracked all the way up. Right? Because we're also not taking care of ourselves. We're taking on a whole lot, but not taking care of the foundation, our true soul, so we can really be at our best for all of the things that we have on our plate. And I think the other part of that is understanding that our productivity does not equal work, which also I think goes back to our enslaved ancestors, right? If you were the biggest, if you were the strongest, how much could you produce out on the fields? If you weren't producing and you couldn't do anything, you were no good. So how is that now still carrying on where for some strong Black women, we're so over-involved, over-committed in so many different activities, organizations, sororities, ribbon and running with our kids, our partners, sometimes being over-involved in other people's affairs because we think it's our role or job to fix and save them. Right, where it's now costly. And so sometimes we may have a hard time saying no or putting boundaries up because it's like, wait a minute, well, people don't need me anymore, right? If then who am I? What is my worth? What is my productivity? Because we haven't learned that it comes from just inherent worth. I am great and deserving of all the great things just because I am woman, just because I am Camila, just because I am Anita, not because of who I help or what I do. Because the moment those things stop, then what? And so sometimes the over-involvement is really about filling this internal need, a void of worth and value.
You preaching tonight, ain't you? Mother, yes, I almost had to get up out my chair. That was amazing. Look, you know, one of the things, and I know that you also are a social work supervisor. I have the honor of supervising a community of social workers. And one of the things that I see is they do the work in their agencies and organizations, but then they're trying to be Captain Save-A-Ho in their families and all in other people's business when that's not even theirs to carry. It's like I heard someone say, put it on a jacket that doesn't belong to you. And I think, you know, that strong Black woman that you just described, oh my goodness, within the social work profession, social workers doing it within their agencies and organizations and even doing it within their families and communities.
Yeah, I call it network stress. So it's the stress from people in our professional, personal networks. I could be just fine, but let me get a phone call or a text message and someone is, oh my gosh, let me tell you what happened, right? And if I am taking on their stress, their emotions, that didn't have anything to do with me. And so when we're talking about boundaries, sometimes a boundary means I can still care about other people without being over-involved and taking on their problems as my own. Oh my gosh, I'm so sorry to hear that. That must be really tough. I know you're going to make it through. Or asking questions, redirecting. But in no way does that mean that I now have to become over-involved in this, especially if I was not asked for help. Because sometimes we are interjecting ourselves. Nobody asked you for help. Nobody asked you, right? But we're doing that again because it's filling some kind of internal need. And so I can care without me needing to be over-involved and taking on other people's stuff. Because again, it's network stress. So I'm going to give back to other people what is theirs.
Love it. Give them their jacket back. And I love that you said, and I will not ask you to expound on this, but I love that you said it's trying to validate an internal need. And so then the work is, because I would love therapists who have therapists, is to figure out what that need is you're trying to fill by going above and beyond doing all of that extra stuff. So that's amazing. I'm going to stop myself because, oh my goodness, I could ask you so many questions just about that. But I really wanted to hear about your social work journey and how did you get here and where would you like to go? So start wherever you want to start and tell me about your social work journey.
So I have been in the industry for going on 18 years now. So initially growing up, I wanted to be a lawyer. Wanted to be a lawyer. I had no idea about mental health. Those words were not used. I didn't know anything about social work, therapy, none of that. But people would always come to me, even as a teenager, asking for my advice, my perspective on just different things, my ability to be able to listen, give feedback without kind of telling people what to do. And I had always been fascinated with how the brain worked, why people did what they did, what makes them tick. So my undergraduate degree was criminal justice, but I had a minor in psychology. And so my plan was to, apply for law school after undergraduate school. Unfortunately, I allowed fear to divert me from that path. But my first job, I was a juvenile probation officer, and I was living in Charlotte, North Carolina. And the 2.5 years I was in that role, the role was very punitive because by the time those adolescents came to me, they had already been adjudicated for some type of crime. And so it really was, these are the conditions that the court has laid out in regards to your probation. You either do these things and you're off, or if you violate, there's going to be some other punitive actions. And just kind of building relationships with these families, I'm like, these kids are not really bad kids, right? It was circumstance, or a lot of them at that time were getting involved with gangs because they were missing components of what they wanted from their family. And if you think about it, a gang does kind of operate as a family. There's structure, there's rules, there's hierarchy, there's all the things. And so I really wanted to be in a place where I could help people versus punishing them, because at that time, that's what I felt my role was. And then unfortunately, I had some really bad situations where I had some kids get killed just, based on some things that they were involved in the community. And I decided that I was ready to make a shift. And so from there, I went into foster care and adoption. At that point, I started my MSW degree, transfer out here to Houston, finished at University of Houston's Graduate College of Social Work. And that really just kind of opened the doors. Now, I didn't really know what I wanted to do in social work. I was just told if I was going to pursue a master's degree, I need to be able to get licensed. And at that time, I didn't know anything about the LPC route. It was just social work. So that was honestly how I got here. But since that time, I've done so many different things in regards to parent education and nonprofit settings. I've been an outpatient director at some psychiatric hospitals and their PHP IOP programs. Have done case management work. And then the last 6 years, I have been in private practice full time as the owner and clinical director of KBT Counseling Consulting. Again, I had no idea about private practice. That was not a dream of mine. I just knew in 2018, I was real uncomfortable. I was like, I've been in the field X amount of time. I like this, I like that, but I wasn't just really feeling fulfilled. And so God was very disruptive. And I just started meeting people who were in private practice. And that was really what kind of opened up those doors. But what really pushed me to start my own and to have an own private practice specifically catered for Black women, I was in a group practice. I was the only clinician of color who was there, experiencing some microaggressions. I noticed that the few Black clients that I was able to work with were not able to stay in treatment long because that practice was self-pay. And so there was financial instability for them that impacted their treatment. And so I said, okay, wait a minute. I can't be doing this personal like campaign about Black mental health and we need to go to therapy, but you need to pay me $100-something, And so at that time, I was having an internal battle with that. The practice, there was no need for them to start accepting insurance because they were thriving. They were thriving well. So that was what then led me to start KBT Counseling Consulting. So that way I could provide quality mental health services that were also affordable for people who look like me.
I love that. One of the two things I was thinking, Camila, One, you said unfortunately fear swerved you onto another path, but you are thriving, using one of your words, as a social work. But so was it really unfortunate?
That's true. That is that's very that's yeah, that is definitely a different perspective.
I was like, unfortunately, you're LCSWS. Is it really unfortunate? I love it. But then the other is, you know, and I've talked to a couple of people since, but I was talking to a social worker, and, you know, we're here in the South. And as she is blossoming into a new LCSW, we were talking about what her future plans were. And she hesitantly said, I want to work with people of color. And she was almost scared to be able to say that out loud. One, as social workers, we've been trained to, you got to work with everybody, right? And, you know, you and a couple other folks lately, I'm getting the honor of hearing you proudly and boldly say, it is my intention to work with Black people, and for you specifically, Black women. And I'm wondering, you know, you've been doing this almost as long as I have. How did you find yourself out of that box that they have put us in this profession, that it is okay to say, I want to work specifically with this population and specifically with the population that looks like me?
If I'm being honest, I don't think I've ever been someone who's followed the crowd. My dad has always just been like, you're a leader, not a follower. So for me to stand on my own, as long as I'm not doing anything unethical, illegal, and I can look at myself in the mirror, I feel just fine about it. So I honestly didn't have, it was not a challenge for me to need to find my niche in working with Black women. Now, if I'm honest though, when my I went from a solo practice to group practice. And so with my business hat on, which is very different from my therapist clinical hat, business-wise, it was, oh my gosh, once we got to a certain point, are you leaving money on the table? Are you isolating, you know, other people by only saying that you work with Black people? Because I'm out networking, I'm doing speaking engagements, and people are like, oh, you know, well, who do you work with? What's your specialty? When it was someone who was white asking me that, I will be honest, I cringed a little bit, or I would maybe try to reword because I didn't want to offend them, right? Because they were so excited until I said who I work with, which then obviously meant that, not that they were excluded, right? As social workers, we cannot discriminate. I have male clients, I have clients of other ethnicities and races. But the specialty was working with Black women. So I will be honest, business-wise, when I got to a certain point, I did say, can you, you know, is there other language that you need to use? Or is this going to prevent you from continuing to scale? And it was uncomfortable. And I'll be honest, I was like, well, maybe I can include the brown community in that. And it was like every single time I tried to do that, to operate outside of where I started, it didn't last long. So I just had to say, Camila, it is okay. There are spaces that are not for you, and they are unapologetic about that. So just keep doing what you're doing. When you're serving people in the right way, you won't have to worry about some other things. So
have you gotten over feeling cringy or hesitant when asked by non-BIPOC people what your niche is? Have you gotten over that yet?
Honestly, no, because I went to a recent networking event probably about 2 weeks ago. I was one of three Black women there. Everyone else, you know, was not of color. And same thing, as soon as I mentioned I was a therapist, oh, great, what's your specialty? Felt a little cringy, if I'm being honest. Yeah.
I'm ready for us to get to that where we can just be as bold and big and beautiful about saying it too. And I hope these spaces where we get to say it loud and proud help us practice saying it in other spaces as well. So we're getting there. We're getting there. Yeah. So it's okay. So how did you decide to go into private practice? I guess I'm wondering, because here you are doing in the community, doing great work. And then you're just like, I'm going to just step out on faith because, so, you know, that's one of the things too, that people are like, it's safe in the agency and organization. I know I'm going to get a paycheck. I know that I don't have to worry about billing, all of that stuff, and to step out and do your own practice and then to take on other people that you're responsible for, that is a huge leap of faith.
Yep. You know, to be honest, I didn't really know what I was getting myself into, because you don't know what you don't know until you're in it. So what led me into private practice? So actually, when I was getting my master's in social work degree, I was very specific in saying that I did not want to do clinical work. And so I actually did the leadership and administration track. And so my jobs after that have been program manager, program director, things of that sort. I still love the work, the clinical work, but I just knew I did not want to be doing that full time. And it's very funny, tell God what you're not going to do and watch how hard he laughs, right? Private practice one, and then doing the clinical work. And again, 2018, very, very uncomfortable. What's going on, Lord? I'm not satisfied. I literally had applied and gotten accepted to an MBA program. I was getting ready to just totally get out of the field because I felt that there was a salary cap. I felt like I had done kind of all of the jobs that I wanted to do, and maybe I just need to switch and do something different. And just started meeting people who were talking about private practice, started getting curious about what that meant, worked for a group practice for about a year and a half. I think I just knew that failure was not an option for me. And that probably is also how I was raised as well. I just said, what's my biggest fear? What are my biggest concerns about private practice? And so if I can reduce those, what then is in my way? And for me, the biggest things was just money. I did not grow up poor. I'm not about that struggle life. And so I just need to at least make what I was making at the agency. And so paid off debt. You know, I had a little financial plan, have a little cushion. And I just said, we're hitting this thing running. And that was it. That was it. All of the other things just came along the way. So what happens now when I'm full? I can't take on any more clients. What is a waiting list? What does that mean? And people are actually waiting a few months on this waiting list for me. What happens pandemic when I scale from being a solo practitioner up to now having 7 clinicians and a whole full-time admin working? That is a whole other beast. And so I think as I just kept growing and just staying focused and scaling, it was just like, okay, this is a new challenge. Okay, I didn't know I had to do this. Okay. And so you're really just learning real time. And now I'm at a place, this makes 6 years of full-time private practice. Let's look at the last couple of years, right? Having a practice before the pandemic, shifting telehealth, you know, being responsible for other people. The quiet quitting, the great resignation, all of the huge tech venture capital companies that have entered the mental health industry that has changed a lot of what's functioning and has impacted smaller group practices like myself. And so what now does it look like for you? Where you want to go? What is working? What doesn't work in this new season? But I think one of the things I can say is that the skills and the experience are so transferable, and there are so many more doors and options and opportunities that have become available, honestly, by private, you know, practice. I didn't know anything about coaching. I didn't know anything about speaking. I have workbooks. I have journals. I host events. And so I think just keep showing up and being open allows for some different things to come your way. And then I get to choose now.
Yes, you have full autonomy on what the next steps are going to be. That is awesome. And congratulations on 6 years. That is amazing.
Thank you.
I want to transition us to your speaking engagement and the one that I found out about and learned about you. But as we prepare for the Affirming Our Presence Behavioral Health Conference, why did you decide to submit a speaker proposal? And why do you feel spaces like this conference are necessary?
I actually probably on Instagram found out about the conference last year, and it was too late for me to submit my proposal to be a speaker, and too late to kind of organize what I needed to do to be physically present. But I love working with and supporting other Black women, particularly entrepreneurs. From the people that I did know who attended the event, they had great things to say. They are coming back this year. Jasmine is just so authentic, and her spirit is just so sweet. And so I was just like, this is something that I definitely want to be a part of, personally and professionally.
Why do you feel like spaces like the Affirming Our Presence Behavioral Health Conference are important?
You know, I'm a clinical supervisor, and one of my supervisees told me that several years ago, after he got his LMSW, that he always wanted to be a therapist. But based on the images he had seen, based on his own experience at that time, he was like, I don't think I meet the criteria or the persona to be a therapist. And so that caused him to go a different way temporarily. He's kind of circled back. So I think it's important because even as professionals, we deal with microaggressions. I think therapy has been a little colonized. There are certain modalities and frames of thought that don't quite work for our community. And so I think it's important for us to have spaces like this where we as clinicians of color can really get the training, the support that we need, in the perspective of how to work best with our community in a way that we're comfortable and authentic as well, right? So I can wear my locks, you can wear your big flowy fro and not feel that I'm wild and I'm not being professional. That I can speak to my clients in a way that is still culturally responsive and professional. Right. So I can really reach them so they're feeling seen, valued, and heard, and I can really help them in the best way. So I think that's why it's important.
Yeah. And I love that you said that those attendees that went last year are coming back this year. Mm-hmm. And so that affirms that people who look like us, women who look like us, are getting what they need from spaces like this, and we'll get to do it again this year as well, and you get to speak. So congratulations on getting accepted. That is awesome.
I know. I am super, super excited and looking forward, not just to speaking, but for me to also attend as well. There are some really amazing workshops, and so I'm going to be coming to get some nuggets that can help continue to make me a great clinician.
Absolutely. And let's talk about your session topic, Empower Her Presence. I love that play. That was great. Empower Her Presence, Elevating Your Client Attraction Game. After hearing your social work journey, it feels like you are the perfect person to speak on this. Can you give us a brief description of your session topic?
Absolutely. So we mentioned earlier that sometimes people feel like, oh, you're social workers, you can and should work with everybody. I don't believe that, right? I think that we all have our zones of genius, and that when we are very clear on one, our just natural passions, who we are, we get to really focus and shine in one area. I think sometimes it's going back to the strong Black woman where we're trying to serve everybody. We're stretching ourselves too thin versus really just kind of focusing and being a specialist. So the concepts that I'll be teaching is also what has really helped me grow and to be known in the community as the therapist for the strong Black woman, right? Because I had to get very specific on that niche. And so the things that we'll be talking about in the workshop is, one, let's get clarity on your ideal client. What's that avatar? What are their pain points? How are your services, your offerings, your products going to be the solution to their problem? That's the only reason why we're in business, because we're trying to solve a problem. And then what are the marketing strategies in regards to your messaging, where to find those clients, and then that client experience to make sure that we are retaining them? I think now, particularly since the pandemic, the mental health field kind of therapy can be a bit oversaturated depending on where you're located. And so How do you stand out amongst the competition? What is going to make you different when someone is going on Psychology Today or Therapy for Black Girls, those therapy directories? How are you going to stand out amongst the crowd? Because while there's still maybe a oversaturation of therapists, there are still way more people who need help. But if they cannot find us, we're just like the best kept secret. I don't want you to be the best kept secret. I want everybody to know about who you are and what you do. Because we can't serve everyone, right? So if I get a call for maybe an adolescent, or I get a call for someone who may have the specific diagnosis, I have my list of people. Hey, this therapist that I know specializes in autism, right? This one specializes in working with men. This one specializes in working with kids under the age of 10. We don't need to compete with each other, right? We can collaborate or refer, because everybody has their specific niches. So when I have coached other therapists, when they are trying to build or scale their practice, one of the things I hear is, oh my gosh, I don't want to niche down because I'm going to leave people out. I want to serve everybody. How your messaging to serve everybody is going to look very different from my messaging for a specific population. Right. If it's too general, people don't really know how you can help them. Okay, so you're a therapist. So is everybody else now. But like, what makes you different? Why should I choose you? Why should I work with you? Do you really understand my problems and what my challenges are? And so really getting clear on that and not being fearful. So it's shifting that therapist mindset from a mindset of scarcity. Oh my gosh, I'm not going to have enough clients, so I need to work with everybody, versus when I can really niche down and become a specialist, now I'm operating out of a mindset of abundance, because now my people are going to come to me. You don't go to your, PCP if you're having like OBGYN issues. You go to an OBGYN. You can't go get your eyes checked from a dentist. Yeah, they're all doctors, but everybody has a specialty for a reason.
Absolutely. I just wrote down, it's one of my favorite phrases that I say, there's enough for all of us to eat. And it feels like, especially if you show up as your authentic self, one, the people who are attracted to what you have to offer will find you. Mm-hmm. And so then that means you don't have to go out and try to get everything. You can just get what you're passionate about. And that diminishes the burnout rate, right?
Because absolutely.
You're doing the work that you are passionate about and mm-hmm. serving the people that you want to. That is awesome. Yeah. If there was one thing the people who are going to be attending your conference session, what's the one takeaway you want them to take away from what you say?
That they are the secret sauce.
Mm.
So you can't be afraid of yourself. You can't be afraid of being authentic and showing up on what makes you different. You're the secret sauce. And we have to stop hiding if we want to be seen, if we want to help.
Stop hiding.
Stop hiding.
And so let's let you shine for a second, for a few couple of minutes. What is some, I started following you on LinkedIn and I love your master classes. I heard you also talk about coaching. Talk to me about what are some of the things outside of, because you said you're expanding, you're pivoting even mm-hmm. outside of the clinical piece of the private practice. So shine a little bit. Tell us what else you're doing.
I appreciate that. As a therapist, I still do clinical work. I still have a small caseload of clients that I see. Recently, EMDR trained last year. So really excited about adding that to my therapy repertoire to really help Black women go a little bit deeper to address their trauma. But I really, really do enjoy coaching. I started off coaching, doing business coaching with other therapists to help them build or scale their private practice. But the life coaching in regards to still helping the strong Black woman, but in a different way, is where I'm kind of pivoting to now. And so quarter two, I'm so excited. Yesterday, I announced my upcoming masterclass, which will be next Wednesday, April the 10th, from 6 p.m. And this is entitled Superwoman Unmasked, because we are shedding impossible standards. So that's the first masterclass that's coming up next week. I also have an in-person event on Saturday, April the 27th from 12 p.m. to 2 p.m. And that is about soul care, about how we can take a pause to be able to pour back into ourselves, because a lot of times we are tired, we are burned out because our cup is depleted. And so this is a special, intimate, small event for these strong women to come in and pour back into themselves. So I'm super excited because the venue is Black female owned. It is going to be at a crystal shop. So we'll be having our herbal manifestation teas. There will be a sound bowl meditation. We'll be doing affirmations. We'll have our sister circle so we can just release some of the heaviness in a safe, supportive environment. And then I'm super excited that everybody will get to make their own customized candles. That will have whatever crystals that they want to put in there, herbs, and all of the things. So this will be their own takeaway candle that they'll have as a physical reminder to make sure that they are taking care of their soul and pouring back into themselves. And then on May 1st, we will be launching the 5-week group coaching course called Reclaim Her. So this is going to be the opportunity for the strong Black women to reclaim her time, peace, and energy by going over those four concepts that I mentioned earlier in regards to boundary mastery, emotional liberation, empowered surrender, soul care, and self-compassion. So super excited about some things that I have going on in this couple months.
Absolutely. I love it. That is a pivot if I ever heard one. I love that. You know what, Camila? I literally, for Social Work Month, I had the honor of taking 10 of my supervisees to a vibrational sound healing this past month. And what, you know, they're playing the bowls and the vibrations and the different sounds. But I think my favorite sound of that, of the those two evenings, were hearing their snoring, because I knew that they were deeply relaxed, and to hear beautiful Black women in this social work field feeling safe and deeply relaxed. Oh, it was a beautiful thing. And so to hear you say that you guys are about to have that experience in the next couple of weeks, and this is in Houston, Texas.
Yes.
Right. And we're going to make sure we have the link that so if people are interested, they can find if there's any spots left. But that was my favorite part, was listening to them snoring, because I knew that they felt safe and they felt deeply relaxed. And so I love hearing that you're doing that with your people.
I don't think people realize that when you're safe and relaxed, you can actually sleep better. You can play, right? A lot of times we're so guarded, we're on edge, we're constantly assessing for something, the shoe to drop, somebody or something to come and get us, that we are just on edge. But when we feel safe and secure, sleep, play, creativity is much easier to come by and for us to experience. So I'm glad that you gave your supervisees that opportunity.
Yeah, it was awesome. I love that they were willing to try something new. They know me, I'm a hippie. So so they're like, let's see what Renita's doing now. So I love that you're doing that with your people in Houston. So awesome. Mm-hmm. You know, you've been doing this for almost 2 decades, Camila.
Listen, we talked about that Black Don't Crack. I'm older than I look.
It's absolutely beautiful. But I know you first started out in the field. You know, you talked about you came from criminal justice psychology into social work because you had to get licensed. And I love that you said that, because they do not talk about that enough in undergraduate. You know, get a degree where you can get licensed in. And that was so important. But I'm sure there was probably a belief that maybe that, you know, oh, what is this social work thing about? And or you heard from your classmates or your professors that has shifted or changed for you in these last 2 decades. What is that one belief that you started on this journey with that you feel has changed the most for you?
I would say the number one myth is that social workers are poor and you cannot make money in this field. That was just what I heard. I heard it. To be honest, my parents discouraged me and encouraged me to major in a different field, because again, it was just like, Camila, you're not going to make any money. And we didn't grow up like this. If you want to help people, that's fine. But like, volunteer, you know, on Saturdays. Don't make this your entire career. And it was almost like just entering the field. It was just something that I accepted, that I just would not make any money. But when you're 21, money is relative. So my first job, I was working for the state of North Carolina. I think my annual salary was like 27 something thousand dollars. You got paid once a month. At the beginning of the month, you have to have really great money management to let that little check stretch for the entire month. And so at that time, with that little amount of money, I was still shopping every weekend. I was still taking trips. So it was like, you know, what is this concept? People, you got to make a whole lot of money. I'm good. We in 2014. My lifestyle has changed. And so that's not going to get it anymore. but what I have learned, particularly since entrepreneurship, is that I have made more as an entrepreneur than I ever have in any of the jobs that I have had working for someone else. And I also have more freedom of time, freedom of thought. I get to have more options in what it is that I want to do, what it is I don't want to do, who I choose or choose not to work with. So I think that is one of the myths that I have definitely proven to not be true, is that we're poor. And I will also say that early in my career, when I really was doing kind of more entry-level social work, other people would shame me. So if I would go to social events, networking events, what do? Oh, I'm a social worker. Oh, bless your heart. You must have a big heart, because I know you and teachers, y'all just don't make money. I literally had a guy who was talking to me, and as soon as I told him what I did as a profession, stopped talking to me. It was just like, oh, you don't make any money. What's the point of me talking to you? Okay. And so not only was there this general just belief in the social work field itself, right, that you weren't going to make a lot of money, that there was going to be a salary cap, other people, based on stigma, their limited information about the field, also kind of caused like some shame in regards to that as well. So I would try to find different ways to come up with what it is that I did, so I wouldn't hear those responses from people. But now I'm like, I'm a therapist. And people are like, oh, really? I'm looking for one. Now, you still have people who are going to be say something interesting. but I'm a lot prouder about what it is that I do and the impact that I'm making.
Awesome. Good. Because you're a social worker. And amazing. Six-figure social worker who's teaching other social workers how to get there as well. And so you're definitely breaking up that myth. I've loved this conversation. I'm just smiling. My cheeks hurt. This has been so good. But we are at our last question or so. And so what are you looking for? We're going to bring it back to the conference. What are you looking forward to the most from attending the conference? And what do you hope attendees will gain after attending your session or just the conference in general?
Yeah, great question. I am looking forward to networking, connecting. There are quite a few other speakers on the roster where we're probably like Facebook friends and followers. So excited to meet some of these amazing clinicians in person. I said as well, I'm interested in attending some of the workshops as well, so I can learn and take back some gems and nuggets for myself and my clients. And for those who are attending my workshop, come ready to learn, to be open, to walk away with understanding how you are the secret sauce to solve the problems of your ideal client, so you can shine in your area of genius, be happy with what you're doing, and make some coins.
Is there anything left to say? I think that was a mic drop. I love that. But I will ask, are there any final words of wisdom or advice you would like to leave our audience with today?
Motto: that it's okay not to be okay. We do not have to have it all together. There's no such thing as perfection. There is so much strength and vulnerability. And we really just have to make sure that we're just taking care of ourselves, particularly in the helping profession. I have to be at my best to be able to serve the people and just deal with, you know, the weight that comes with the work that I do. Because if I'm not okay, it's gonna show up in other areas. And really understanding the power that I have in this role that I serve, I want to make sure that I'm always at my best. So do what you need to do to take care of yourself so we can take care of other people.
Absolutely. And I think a good way to take care, because our social work code of ethics actually says that we need both personal and professional self-care. Mm-hmm. And the Affirming Our Presence Behavioral Health Conference, June 20th to 23rd in Plano, Texas, is a perfect way to fulfill that requirement.
Yes, because not only are we learning professionally through the conference and the workshops, there are also some super dope social activities as well, because hello, balance, right. That I'm looking forward to as well. So I think the lineup, the model of the conference definitely embodies what it is that we need to be role modeling for ourselves, clients, and colleagues.
And those social workers coming after us are going to not go a different route because they're starting to see we are affirming our presence. So thank you, Jasmine, for putting this conference on. And thank you, Camila, for coming on the Goddesses of Social Work podcast today. It was such an honor to have you.
I appreciate so much for you having me here as a guest. This was a great conversation.
Thank you for listening to today's episode of the Goddesses of Social Work podcast. We are glad you were here. If you liked this episode, please come back to hear more stories of the journeys through social work, and please leave us a review on Apple or Spotify. See you next time here on the Goddesses of Social Work podcast.